stupid ass way. One day in paradise, I'd sing for all the ladies up there, and they would sing along with me, and we'd be so happy there to be, cause down below it's really nowhere. My name would then be Jupiter, and I would know where I was going, become unknowing my bed, so very long and put it all away. Would sing my childhood song to me about the time they called me Jackie. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, cute in a stupid ass way. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. This is CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the show where we talk about comics. And we're actually live this week. It's weird. It's been, seems like a long time since Colin and I have made it into the booth. Has it, Colin?
Well, you've been away, so
yeah.
It's been a few weeks.
It's been a while. We played some pre-recorded interviews a lot recently. I'm very honored this week. We are joined by Mr. Chester Brown, who is the creator of Yummy Fur, which includes the storylines of Ed the Happy Clown. What else was it? The Playboy, I Never Liked You, and The Little Man, Colin's being my cue card lady. And his latest book, which is available in fine book and comic stores and libraries, Louis Riel, a historic biography of the great Métis Rebellion leader. If you don't know about him, you weren't paying attention in your Canadian history classes in high school. So thank you for coming and joining us today, Chester.
Hey, Robin. Hey, Colin.
Hello.
We're very happy to have you here. And I guess we'll start out maybe talking about Louis Riel, your latest book.
Okay.
And then try and cover some of your past books. And if possible, I got some questions about your next book.
Okay.
The one I've heard rumblings and rumors about from different people. And kind of, you know, things about your work that I've noticed and have questions about, and, you know, style, development of style, what kind of tools you use, because Colin was pointing out that I will ask about tools and mocking me.
I wasn't
thoroughly.
I didn't do it on air, though.
No. No, he was doing it previous, yeah. And if, in case you haven't seen it, there's an Inkstud's flyers at finer comic stores where he makes a point of pointing out how I asked that question in a little wee comic strip. So, Louis Riel, your latest book, what was the impetus to kind of stop doing the autobio, then the surreal, I guess, is under, surreal a good way to describe underwater?
I didn't think of it as surreal.
Embryonic?
Weird. Fantasy material, I guess. I don't know.
Fantasy is one of those terms, though, that if you're not careful, will turn into, like, Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
But it's, Underwater was neat. It's a total experimental development of linguistic development of the species. We'll get into that later. But Louis Riel, what was the change for you to take on a completely different subject than really the rest of your body of work.
I suppose it was... well, I'd developed an interest in politics, and so it grew... wanting to do the book grew out of that interest.
Was it something with Louis Riel? Because there is some themes in this that reflect in your past work, that sense of identity, of unsure identity, which I find in... I can't even... I keep wanting to say the original term you used. Fuck, that storyline. It's college radio. Listener discretion be advised.
I was told not to cuss on the air, and here's the...
Who told you not to cuss?
We encourage people to cuss on the air.
Where's my itinerary?
Oh, your itinerary?
My itinerary says... Notes. Live to air. Try not to cuss too much.
Oh, who wrote those notes?
I don't know.
They've never listened to the show then. Yeah,
the Drawn and Quarterly publicist, maybe? I don't know.
If you're listening, Drawn and Quarterly, you can cuss on Ink Studs. Well, I will do listener discretion be advised, because, you know, we're going to talk about some of the subject matter, like with Playboy, and, I mean, it's mature subject matter. You're going to cuss occasionally. You don't have to cuss. You don't want to cuss. I cuss. I'm a trucker. So, yeah, Louis Riel, it's that identity. Is that something that you've really thought about with your work, like focusing on that loss of identity or unsure identity?
I don't know. Have I? It's never occurred to me that that's a theme of mine. But certainly all the religious stuff, the questions about sanity and whatnot, that's all reflected in the book and in, you know, previous works of mine.
Especially with the story in Underwater about your mother's, I don't know if I want to say battle with schizophrenia, because
yeah, there
you take
really...
a really unique stance on it where it's like, I'm not sure if I get quite what you're saying. It's not that it's necessarily a mental health disorder, but almost like a shamanistic thing was part of what you're going to. Am I going the right way?
Well, I'm not saying that all schizophrenics are shamans.
But it's kind of like a byproduct also of modern society.
I'm saying there's a connection there. And I don't think it's a byproduct of modern society. I mean, people have, you know, gone into these realms throughout millennia. It's just we define it differently than people used to define it, I think.
And that was one of the things about Louis Riel that really stuck out to you as a historical figure?
That was one of the things, although really it was the political aspect of the story that was that initially appealed to me most, the whole rebellion against the government thing.
Canada's a lone rebellion.
not the lone one.
Well, there was the 1837.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I was about to say that. If you hadn't jumped in.
Colin is a bit of a history buff, and I've taken one post-secondary history course in Canadian history, which was a year ago, and I've probably forgotten most of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I showed my professor, Louis Riel, and she was really impressed with it, and every time I talked to her, what was that book again? What was it called? Louis Riel. Yeah, so.
Well, I was wondering what the reaction was to the book from historians of the period.
The only Canadian historian I can remember... Actually, I'm pretty sure the only Canadian historian I've talked to about the book is Christopher Moore.
Mm-hmm.
He was favorably inclined to the book. He you know, said very nice things about it. I asked him, you know, did I make any mistakes? Is there anything that he'd want to point out, that I did wrong? And he didn't have anything. He didn't say anything, so... and that's the only one. I have talked to Maggie Siggins, but I guess she's not like a professional historian. She took issue with Well, she her take on Riel is she sees him as a very heroic figure, and I guess she thought I wasn't reverential enough or something. But she still liked the book and wrote a nice piece about it.
Was that important for you to kind of give him that human aspect, give that character to him, so people can kind of see what he's struggling with and what he's dealing with?
I was more interested in telling the story. To tell the story, you have to deal with characters, so you've got to give your characters personality to some extent, but that wasn't a primary interest. And my concerns weren't, shall we say, fictional ones. It seems to me that most fiction is interested in getting into the emotional life of its character, of the characters, and I wasn't interested in that at all. There are a few thought balloons in the book where it was necessary to convey image or convey information that couldn't be conveyed any other way, but the emphasis certainly wasn't on what's going on in Riel's mind or in any of the other characters' minds.
And thought balloons, that's a technique you very rarely... Like, I was going through stuff, and I couldn't recall seeing any other thought balloons.
I'm sure.
Except for, like, your own internal dialogue and your autobiography work.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's... I know some cartoonists don't like to use it because it just seemed like, how do you know what that person's thinking?
Uh-huh.
Well, one of the things I did get from reading Riel was a sense of emotional detachment from the characters.
Yeah.
And that was deliberate on your part.
Yeah, very very deliberate. And, it wasn't just a matter of not using thought balloons, but also not having any close-ups of the characters. All the, shall we say, camera angles, or the camera was always at a distance from the action. Also, the use of the little orphan Annie blank eyes.
I was wondering about that. It's like the small heads and the large bodies, it just reminded me so much of Daddy Warbucks, Little Orphan Annie.
Yeah. Yeah, Gray, Harold Gray, who drew Little Orphan Annie, a famous comic strip published from the 20s to the 1960s. Actually, it might still be running, but...
Probably not by the same person.
Yeah, Gray died in 68 or 69, so to my way of thinking, this strip stopped then. There was a good deal of emotional restraint in that strip. That's what I was going for, restraint.
Was that so you could tell the story more clearly?
I'm just not interested in that side of things, emotions, and this is a story about politics and actions and the results of those actions.
Now, when you originally started working on Louis Riel, was the art style, was that what you originally intended, or did you kind of go through different things before you finally settled on that?
Yeah, the style changed over time. I was always trying to make it look Harold Gray-like, but at the beginning it was a more modified Harold Gray style, and I was drawing heads that were sort of largish and bodies that were smallish, and that was more a concession to my own style. But as I kept looking at Gray's work while I created the book, the style grew more and more like Gray's, and Gray drew these large bodies and with tiny heads on top, and that's how all the figures ended up looking by about the halfway point in the series.
I think that's neat because it kind of goes for what you're talking about, that kind of that cold character detachment. So you have these characters more focused on just them being there than necessarily, that character with that funny eye or that, that wonky nose and stuff. It's just more, there's that person taking up that space and this is the actions they're doing.
Mm-hmm. So I, by the time I'd finished the comic book series, I had a problem in that about half of the book, or maybe one third of the book, Riel looked one way with a large head and a small body, and then the rest of the book he had a small head and a large body. So for when we published it as a book, I went back and I redrew the first third of the book.
Oh, wow.
Every panel that Riel appears in, and every panel that MacDonald, because Sir John A. MacDonald changes over the course of the book too, as does Gabriel Dumas, although there aren't many scenes with Gabriel Dumas in the early book. But anyway, so there's one or two. So all the scenes with those characters, I had to redraw all the panels. The first third of the book.
Wow, I did not know that. There go, Colin was asking beforehand, did you change anything in the book? Well,
and you said, save that question for the air.
Yeah. I'm always, I think that's a great question to ask. I'm going to take a quick music break now. It's about 20 past or 20-something past. We're going to play Queen Bitch by David Bowie.
Okay, great.
And if you have any questions for Chester, you can call us at 604-822-2487. I don't remember which disc thing I put it in. Okay, I think it's a top one. Okay. CITR 101.9 FM, Queen Bitch by David Bowie from the Great Hunky Dory album.
My weekends are at an all-time low, 'cause she's hoping to score, so I can't see her letting him go. Walk out of her heart, walk out of her mind. Oh, not her. She's so swishy in her satin tan, in her frock coat and bibbidi-bobbidi hat. Oh God, I could do better than that. No time ambassador, a sweet talking night walking games. Oh, she's known in the darkest clubs for pushing ahead of the dames. If she says she can't do it, then she can't do it. She don't make false claims. But she's a queen, and such a queen, such a laughter is sucked in the brains. Now she's leading him on, and she'll lay him right down. Yes, she's leading him on.
CITR 101.9 FM. I was just telling everyone while we're listening to music, I went to this great pub in New York called McSorley's, and this drunken Irish fireman was out front. This was on Wednesday night or Wednesday afternoon when that plane crashed into the building in New York. And so this pub full of drunken Irish firemen were, you know, talking about 9/11 and stuff. When we're about to leave, we're talking to this guy up front. He's saying, go look at the bar, look at the wishbones. Like, what wishbones? Well, he's like, well, all these wishbones, they're from guys from World War II who put it there and said, I'll crack it when I get back.
Oh.
And so
they
never
got back.
So all the wishbones left, and they have about an inch of dust on them. Like, we were trying to find, where are these wishbones? And the bartender just points up, and it's this, like, just black bar. It's pretty incredible. So, I know. My geeky trip to New York. I've never been. That was my first time. And I want to go back. So, we were talking about Louis Riel. I forget what note we were on about it. One question I have. You're very interested in politics and the history and, like, how, I guess Louis Riel had impact, but it was kind of like an impact of, I guess, how little power a minority had. Is that a good way of putting it? It's like an impact of people not being able to do anything?
Well, there's that, but, I mean, there was long-term impact. After his death, the liberals were able to in Quebec. There was the French people were very upset about Riel's execution, so the liberals were able to take advantage of that, and that's how Laurier got one of the reasons why Laurier got into power.
Our first French Canadian Prime Minister,
right,
Sir Wilfrid.
And you know, that's one of the reasons why the liberals were able to hold on to power for so long. They were the dominant party throughout the 20th century.
So you see that as a real turning point in Canadian power dynamics.
Yeah.
Are there any other historical Canadian things that you would like to be able to tackle, but given the amount of time it takes to put together a graphic novel, it's just not an option right now?
Ooh.
I'm sure Colin has about 20.
Yeah, there are one or two. I'm planning on doing more historical work, but those particular projects are ones that are more doable, that I would be able to do the research for, hopefully. But there are one or two projects that just are so daunting and would require so much reading that
look at that smile on Colin's face.
You know, I don't want to say, because
then everyone will be like, so when's that book coming out?
Maybe I will do it at some point,
or Colin will do it.
So yeah, I'd best not say. Yeah,
actually there's something I've been talking about in interviews. I've noticed that a lot of people who have done autobiographical comics also go on to do historical works, and I was wondering,
like who?
Harvey P. Carr. He did the three-part about the story of the guy who was in Vietnam.
Right.
Dennis Eichhorn has done autobiographical works. We also did the History of the Wobblies.
Oh, Denny did that. Oh.
Well, I illustrated it, and Denny wrote it.
Didn't Jackson do some stuff? Autobio stuff? I thought he did some autobio before he went and did history.
No, I don't think so. Okay. But Spain Rodriguez has.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually quite common. But I was wondering if you saw any relationship between the autobiographical and historical.
I mean, you're dealing with real life issues, whether it's your own life or someone else's life. It's all about what happens in people's lives. Of course, my life isn't as eventful, thank God, as Riel's was.
Revolution in Toronto.
But it's being concerned with real life issues, I think.
One thing I was reading, Dave Sim, he has his blog that I guess someone else types out for him.
Right.
That is like an astonishing... I guess I shouldn't say astonished, because it's Dave Sim, and the man can just write and write and write and write and write, and just like there's like just pages and pages of stuff each day. And he was talking about the trip to stay at your place
Okay.
And being like, you have, I forget what the sign was, in your bathroom.
Right.
Because you just get so frustrated.
They mean well.
What is the sign in the bathroom?
When I'm sitting on the toilet bowl, I have reading material in there, usually political magazines. And so I end up getting very angry reading these political magazines about all the injustices in the world, all the evil things that politicians are doing or whatever. And so I get angry, and I was getting angry in there. So I put up a sign in my bathroom saying they mean well, because to remind myself that, you know, most of these people get into politics because they do want to do good in the world. You know, there are a few who get in it for the wrong reasons, who either are corrupt or become corrupt or
want to be like their dad, like Paul Martin.
Yeah, but most of them really do mean well. And so I put that there to, you know, hopefully calm myself down so that going to the bathroom wasn't an experience that made me angry, you know, each time.
Are there any current political things you're finding very interesting and engaging? Or is it just a general level of frustration?
No particular.
It sounds like the general Canadian apathy that everyone has with current political climate. Waiting for something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Colin's looking at me.
Well, I don't know if that's quite fair, but I mean...
Well, we've got the Liberal Party, who's just kind of like duking it out among themselves, and Conservative Party, who's trying to do what they can until the Liberal Party gets organized and stuff. So it's, I guess it's a wait-and-see game.
How much can one cartoonist do about the state of the world?
Well, they can start a riot in Pakistan or something like that.
Man, what did you think of that?
Oh, the whole the Danish cartoon cartoons
thing.
I think that's the same look Joe Sacco gave us.
Well, all along I've been for, you know, freedom of speech and the freedom to publish what one wants. That said, you know, reading Spiegelman's piece about the whole situation in Harper's made it clear what that particular Danish newspaper was about, which I hadn't known before reading the Spiegelman's piece. You know, it's apparently quite a anti-immigration stance that paper has, and certainly I don't agree with that sort of thing.
It's hard to be against immigration and live in Canada.
But of course, you know, I believe in everyone having the right to express viewpoints that people find controversial.
I'm going to transition now. We're about 35 past, and we'll ask some questions about your early work.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, maybe first, I want to know about your next project.
Okay.
Which I read a little bit about. I didn't sit down and read all the correspondence between you and Dave, Mr. Sim.
Right.
Back when Cerebus was still pumping them out. I think it's, this is what you're working on. It's a thing about, I guess, put it bluntly, your love life. Is that a way of putting it?
Well, the focus of the book has changed a little bit, but it starts in 1996 when the first scene is my last girlfriend breaking up with me, and kind of the repercussions from that, including me going to visit prostitutes and whatnot. And it ends in 2004, shortly after the Riel book is published. And so all, you know, stuff in between, stuff happens in between.
I'm just really impressed by the honesty of doing a subject like that. that's one thing that really strikes me about it is a friend of ours, we were talking about earlier, Robin Bougie, was working on a project called the John Project, where he's done different kind of sexual related ones. First one was the girlfriend ex project, or the ex-girlfriend project. Second one was the incest project, where he talks to people about consensual adult and sexual relationships. And his third one is the John Project, where he talks to Johns about their experiences and motivations, yada, yada, yada. All extremely anonymous.
This has been published?
He's working on it right now.
Huh.
I think he's done all his interviews after a lot of hard work of trying to find people. That right. was his most challenging project.
Yeah, because most Johns don't want to talk about it, at least openly in public.
That's I find really interesting that you're... I guess it's kind of continuing more of your early autobio stuff, or just being so honest. And I guess what is that like that in you that kind of makes you want to do such honest work?
The stuff that people are reluctant to talk about is often the stuff that's most important, I think. It's a desire to deal with things that are, I don't know,
taboo.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, that's the thing I find really interesting relating with the Playboy, is you're just kind of putting yourself out there on the table. This is me, this is what I've gone through. And I think I know that you'd received a letter from Hefner, who didn't understand how you could have felt that way. How you know, and I guess it's just like being able to do that kind of honest story so people would.
Yeah, to clarify that, the Playboy was a book about my experiences with pornography, and specifically Playboy magazine. And of course, I was a totally guilt-ridden teen, you know, feeling very ashamed about masturbating as a teenager. And Hefner was surprised that anyone was still feeling guilty about this sort of stuff. He was kind of living in his own, you know, Playboy bubble world, where he thought the Playboy magazine and the sexual revolution in the 60s had changed everything. This was all news to him that
this guy living in a mansion in LA.
But the letter was very sweet. I mean, he was showing kind of a fatherly concern, like, are you all right? It was neat receiving that letter.
That's neat. Exercising demons, I guess, through the book, and he kind of didn't understand
right
people going through that. We're going to take another musical break. CITR 101.9 FM. This is Inkstead. We're going to play Mr. Brian Eno. What was the song again?
Faraway Beach.
Yeah. Off the first solo Eno album, Here Come the Warm Jets, by far my favorite, but they're all good. Take a listen, Inkstuds. If you want to give a call in, ask Mr. Chester Brown a question, 604-822-2487. The piano and thing just doesn't stop. Brian Eno on some faraway beach off Here Come the Warm Jets. So, did I ask you about music yet?
I mean, no. Ask you.
So we chose, I brought a couple of things on a lark, figuring after reading, think, I Never Liked You. You mentioned getting a couple of Bowie records in there.
Yeah.
So I brought Hunky Dory, and we played Hunky Dory, and Colin had mentioned that you're a fan of Mark Almond. So you want to mention how you got, or, you know, some of your music tastes and what you got into? Because people don't ask those questions often. Cartoonists like things other than comics.
Yeah, I'm a huge Mark Almond fan. You know, Almond is best known as the singer for Soft Cell. They did that Tainted Love song, which still gets played, you know, frequently.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And he's had this long solo career that I've been following all these years, because I was a big fan of Soft Cell and became a big fan of Almond's solo work too. And yeah, he's just great. Everything he does is great. You know, there are a couple of stinker albums, but for the most part.
Do you ever see the video this band Coil did for Tainted Love?
No.
He plays the Angel of Death.
Oh, okay.
It's in a. Some people got outraged because it's a 7-minute slow epic about AIDS, and some people got outraged by it, not realizing that the whole band is gay. I thought it was like a hate video, and but now it's in an art museum, and like, you know, part of the permanent installation. The video plays there over and over and over again. I'd hate to be standing next to that playing nonstop for 5 years or something. You recently, speaking of installations, you were artist in residence. Is that right? Writer in residence, artist in residence in Toronto at the library for a month?
Yeah, they called me writer in residence. You know, I am a writer, but I also draw. Yeah, it was for 3 months earlier this year.
And what did that entail?
Not much writing. I was too busy doing other stuff. Prospective cartoonists would submit their work to the library, and I would look it over and then set up a meeting with them. They would come into the library, and I would, you know, talk to them about their work and about comics in general, and give them feedback. A lot of young cartoonists just have no one to turn to for feedback when they're starting out. I know that was the case for me, and probably for you too, Colin. Yeah, there was that, and then I also did some talks for the library, and a couple workshops, and all of this kept me. It was supposed to be. They told me that 60% of your time will be taken up with just doing your own writing, and the other 40% will be devoted to these other things. But it turned out it was more like 90% of my time was taken up with the other things, the workshops and the meetings and whatnot, and I had almost no time to do my own work.
Now, I'm going to use this time talking about that to promote tomorrow, 2 o'clock, you're doing... Now, is it a...
I think it's 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock? 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock?
I've got my schedule here.
The itinerary telling you not to cuss?
Yes, the itinerary that tells me not to cuss also tells me that the event at the Writers' Festival tomorrow is at 1 o'clock.
My bad.
And where is it?
It's on Granville Island, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's on Granville Island. They don't say in my itinerary... Oh, wait. The PTC Studio, Granville Island.
Which I believe is upstairs from the offices of the Readers and Writers Festival's offices.
Oh, there we go.
So it's like on the second, third floor.
So if you want to go check out Chester Brown, 1 o'clock tomorrow. And also if you're near Victoria,
that's right,
at Boland's Books on Sunday night at 7 p.m.
Yep.
For all you listeners. We have a couple minutes left. If you have any questions, don't forget, 822-2487, or I'll just keep asking more and more questions.
So what will you be doing tomorrow at the...
There's the event's called... Something 1,000 words. Worth 1,000 words. It's I'm doing it with another illustrator. I believe she does like three-dimensional work that she photographs. She does plasticine sculpting or something. I haven't seen her books either, but sounds interesting. And so she'll be we'll both be, you know, showing how we work, I guess. And
will it be like a slideshow or PowerPoint presentation, or
I'm more low tech than that. It'll be an overhead projector presentation.
Right.
Yeah, just I'll be showing some. I'll be showing my working process, the script I did for Riel, a few pages, just a few examples of the script, and there's a scene that didn't make it into the book that I'll show and explain why it didn't make it into the book, and also I'll show some recent freelance stuff I've done, some freelance comic strips that haven't been published yet.
Where will those be appearing in eventually?
I don't know if you've heard. You've probably seen some of them have been published already. Penguin is reprinting.
The covers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've
classic
seen.
Classic books with covers by cartoonists.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of them, and I did. For some reason, they gave me Lady Chatterley's Lover. And I did a comic strip for the cover, and so I'm going to show the process of the creation of that cover, the different versions that were sent to the art director, and how we came to choose the final version and that sort of thing.
Did you have to read the book?
Yes.
Yeah.
And how was it?
I'm not that crazy about D.H. Lawrence, apparently.
Well, that shocked me, getting you to do something like that. Like, hearing, you know, that Chris Ware is doing Voltaire. Mm-hmm. That kind of makes sense, I think, a little. But later, that just... Obviously, whoever was doing that really just got a list of name of cartoonists and went, no, there we go, that's good.
Well, despite not being fond of the book, I had enormous fun doing the project, so hopefully, well, I don't know. Maybe there'll be people who'll be happy to buy the book just for the cover. It's a classic book. I'm sure there are people who would enjoy the book despite the fact that I didn't.
Well, I can sort of see a relationship in that. In his time, D.H. Lawrence broke a lot of taboos. Yep. On the subject of sexuality. Mm-hmm. And dealt with things that people didn't talk about, which is something that you do.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm going to ask a couple questions about Ed, because they've been reprinted in the smaller comic form, the same size as Louis Riel.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do any touch-ups to those, like you did with the Louis Riel? And I don't think it completes the whole thing as it is in the Yummy Furs, is it?
It's... I made no changes to the story or the artwork. It's exactly the same way that it was published in the 1992 Vortex edition of the
book.
Okay. Which is different than the way... That has a different ending than the ending that was originally published in Yummy Fur. That's where the story was originally serialized. But I didn't like that ending. It seemed to go on too long, and
it's so about like 16 or 17 issues, I think, the whole story, isn't it?
18 issues.
18.
Yeah. So I cut down the ending for the final book version, and so when we re-serialized it recently, it's that book version rather than the original ending.
And all of your covers, is there any plan to do something with all, like, because you have so many great covers in the Yummy Furs. Any plan to collect those?
Most of them suck.
Ooh. You don't like the picture of yourself with the Harvey Awards as the Ten Commandments?
Well, I guess that's kind of amusing.
I just got shot down. How about, I'm going to ask a couple of questions about your Gospels books you're working
on.
Because that's one of my... As people know, I get my books bound into a big book. And so I have all the Yummy Furs and Underwaters bound in a big book. And one of the reasons is because half the stuff is the Gospels. Mm-hmm. And I find those really interesting and really neat. Is there any plans to continue those?
Yeah, I didn't finish Matthew. When I stopped Underwater, I was... What would it have been? Three-quarters of the way through? I was right at the point where Jesus was about to enter into Jerusalem, which, you know, this is the final days. It's the point where he was about to be crucified. So I'm pretty close to the end of that. And that's when I stopped to do the Riel project. I am planning on finishing Matthew at some point in the future. I'm just not sure when I'll get around to it.
Eventually.
And any of the Gnostic Gospels, would you be interested in adapting those?
Probably not. I was thinking of doing... At one point, I was thinking of doing... what was it? I think it was the Gospel of Pontius Pilate, one of the apocryphal Gospels, although that's actually not a Gnostic one, if I remember correctly. Mm. But it has some great scenes in it. But I discarded that idea. I'm not going to be doing that.
One thing, I don't know if it was just my reading of it, but you drew them at different times, so there's different styles. But it's very visually, Jesus looks different in the Mark one than he does in the Matthew one. In the Matthew one, he looks like he's an angry SOB.
Right.
He's going to kick some heretic ass.
Yeah, I hadn't read the Gospels carefully enough to... In Mark, I did him looking very...
Kind of like gentle, hippie.
Like a traditional Jesus. More like a traditional Jesus, anyways. But doing Mark, all the way through, I was noticing how angry Jesus is described as being in that particular book. So then when I came to do Matthew, I decided, I should make him look more angry, the way he's described all the way through Mark. And then when I was adapting Matthew, I was finding, hey, he isn't described as being angry in here the way he is in Mark. So that was, a goof up on my part, really.
What was it that made you want to do the Gospels? Because I can't think of any kind of alternative comic artist that has done something like that. And it's such a neat balance to Ed, which was such an extreme, just odd story. And you go, the second half of the book is Jesus handing out bread and fish.
I was really interested in learning more about my Christian roots. I grew up in a very religious Christian family, and this was a way of being forced to learn more about it, forcing myself to immerse myself in these works that had such a deep impact on my life, the formation of who I am.
That's, I guess, kind of ties in with wanting to do autobiocomics, and in Yummy Fur, with the starter, one thing I found really neat, the first autobiocomic, which is a straight one about a crazy neighbor.
Right.
And then the second one was kind of you revisiting that and kind of taking it apart and kind of like how you did it and the impact it had, like with your friends, kind of their input. What made that like stories you'd wanted to tell in the comics? Because it's not just, I did this, I'm going to do a comic. Like, your comics are very purposeful, like here's a story, and those were interesting, especially it was such an experimental type, the second part to that, to Helder.
And the question is why I wanted to do
what was that a story for you that really stuck out to do that as an autobio story?
Well, the first one, Helder, seemed like a good autobiographical one to start with, because It felt kind of dramatic. There was conflict between this guy who was acting like a real jerk and me, who's, I'm very mild-mannered. And so stories work well if there's some sort of conflict. And then I felt like I should do a story about what my life is more usually like, which is working on comics. If you're going to do autobiographical comics, then showing what your life is like makes sense. So that's why the second story, Showing Helder, where it was about the creation of the first story.
I quite enjoyed both of them. I just realized it's almost 3. No. Any last questions, Colin?
What, you're not going to have time to play the last Mark Almond song?
Oh, we're going to play the song. That's our transition between shows.
Okay.
That song is getting played.
Because that's a brilliant song. Anyways, what?
Do you still draw your panels individually and paste them down?
Yes. Each panel is drawn separately, not all of them on the same board or piece of paper.
And it gives you more flexibility?
In editing and switching around scenes and that sort of thing, yeah.
Okay. And what do you ink with?
A very fine brush and a Hunt 102 dip pen nib.
Great.
Awesome.
Any more questions?
Thank you for coming down. Check him out tomorrow, 1 o'clock, down on Granville Island. I just got to make sure I'm playing the right CD. Don't want to play the wrong one. And we're playing Orpheus in Red Velvet by Mark Almond off of Enchanted. Thank you very much, Chester, for coming on.
Thank you,
I'm a big
Robin.
Fan. I was, like, so excited. I'm, like, at SPX. We're going, Chester Brown's coming to the studio this week. So it's been awesome. And, Gansine on Sunday, 1 o'clock till 7 o'clock, 215 East 17th. Admission is $5 this Sunday.
At the Cambrian Hall, at the Welsh Hall.
The Welsh Hall. Colin will be there selling his wares. Donald King, friend of mine, friend of yours.
Robin Bougie, I believe.
Bougie will be there, exhausted from many conventioning. The Ink Muffins.
Oh, admission is $5, but you get a free copy of the new Broken Pencil magazine.
Yeah, check it out, Canzine. I'm hoping I'll be able to make it. I don't know yet. Busy. Thank you, Ink Studs. Up next, Rhymes and Reasons. Some hippity hop. Or, sorry, Crimes and Treasons. Oops.
Sweet refrain, my tears are falling like the rain.